from Lodge Grass High School in 68 anyway, and got called into Project 100,000.
What was that?
It was supposedly a program for social uplift. Every year, a percentage that scored at the bottom of the military aptitude test were inducted and then shipped off to Vietnam. Some uplift. I held my mug there, a little away from my mouth. I thought about the file and tried to remember the details. He showed an aptitude for the art of war and got transferred to the 101st Airborne Division's reconnaissance patrol. They were up in the Central Highlands north of Dak To looking for VC alongside this river, and they found them. I sipped my coffee, about two regiments of them. I placed my mug down and looked at her. Small arms fire pinned them down for about 8 hours, 13 dead and 23 wounded. Air support finally arrived, and they started driving the North Vietnamese back enough for them to medevac the wounded out with a T-bar. She started to raise her hand like she was in school. It's a harness and winch system dropped about 100 feet from a helicopter. I leaned in, studying the collection of porcelain, plastic, glass, and wooden bees along the shelf above the range hood. The VC saw that everybody is concentrating on getting the wounded out, so they mounted a counteroffensive. The rest of the platoon hugged dirt and prayed for more support, and suddenly this giant came up out of the ditch beside the road and started moving up and down the line, firing his 16 in single shots, moving from the high spots to the low, each shot taken at a hostile as he went, firing with absolute purpose and never saying a word.
Fuck me.
The report says he went through 3 clips. I took a breath and continued. There were less than 20 men left in the platoon, but the battalion commander, safe in one of the helicopters, radioed back for them to attack again. And believe it or not, they did. This Lieutenant Shields raised his rifle arm up like he's in some bad Audie Murphy movie and screamed, "Follow me!" The whole platoon, including Virgil, broke rank and followed this lieutenant straight into an ambush. Where 6 seconds later, 12 more were dead. 3 were critically wounded, and they're left with only 3 effectives.
One of them being Virgil White Buffalo.
I nodded at the marbled surface of the Formica counter. The wounded were stuck in this gully where Virgil made all 3 trips and dragged each one of them back to the original landing zone, including the lieutenant, who got on the horn and called for extraction, but was told by this colonel in the helicopter that they needed to charge this machine gun nest to their right instead. She ran her fingers through her hair and looked at me in disbelief.
Get the fuck out of here.
This lieutenant started to get up.
No way.
And Virgil smacked him alongside the head with the butt of his M16, knocking him out cold. I watched as she bit her lip to keep from laughing. Then, just for good measure, Virgil rolled over and threw a few rounds at the battalion commander's helicopter. She laughed, and the tourists looked at us. The colonel said, "I've got incoming, I've got incoming," and flew off. I nudged the handle on my mug and noticed the little half ring on the counter that it left behind. So there they were, without any air support or evac, and this lieutenant, Tim Shields, the one that wrote up the report, came to and leaned over to Virgil to say, "We are going to die." Virgil told him that they could slip down in the river, that it's only about knee-deep with a 4-foot berm on either side, so that they could retreat. This lieutenant told Virgil that's a good idea and gave him the M60 and ordered him to provide rear guard as the rest of them retreated a little farther down the river, where they'll wait. She groaned. They left him. So there he sat, alone, with a half-empty M60 machine gun and the better part of a North Vietnamese regiment on the way. The shooting began, and he returned fire and started working his way back down the river for the next 3 hours, alternately dealing with the mosquitoes, leeches, and the North Vietnamese. He got to an embankment that led to a roadway where he tossed the empty M60 into the river, pulled out his sidearm, and started jogging into the night. 3 clicks down the road, he ran into a patrol.
"Ours?"
I nodded. "Yes."
"Thank God."
They called in an evac, and an hour later Virgil was standing tall in front of the same lieutenant and battalion commander who was screaming at him for getting lost and losing the M60. Virgil, after enduring 16 hours of close combat, most of it single-handed, told them to stop yelling at him and that he's going to go take a nap. The lieutenant grabbed Virgil's arm, and Virgil swung around and punched him in the face, breaking his nose and driving the bone shards into his brain, which killed him instantly. She didn't move. Manslaughter at worst. I looked out the windows at the flickering leaves, alternating their light and dark sides. Not in this man's army. The colonel pushed and got a premeditated murder charge stemming from Virgil having struck his commanding officer while under fire in the field. Nobody stepped forward to say anything. And Virgil gets convicted of second-degree murder with a 22-year hard labor sentence in Leavenworth. Vic leaned in.
22 years?
With good behavior, he got out in 17. I tapped the manila envelope that I had put on the counter. I had Ruby check the database, and she came up with the rest. I opened the folder and read the small print on the faxed sheets. On the walk home.
From Leavenworth, Kansas?
I nodded. He was picked up by the Troop E Highway Patrol and told that he can't hitchhike on the interstate. They dropped him off just outside of Abilene, where he got a ride from a fellow by the name of Peter Moore and a young girl, Betty Coleman, who said that they're on their way from East St. Louis and could give him a lift as far as Rapid City. They got up near North Platte, Nebraska, that night, where this Moore says he's tired. Virgil offered to drive, but this guy said that they'll just sleep in the car. The two of them in the front and Virgil in the back. The next morning, Peter Moore was found with his head caved in, and Betty Coleman was picked up by the North Platte Police Department and swore that Virgil did it.
Drugs?
I nodded. Cocaine found on Betty's person and in Peter Moore's bloodstream. Virgil got picked up by the Nebraska Highway Patrol and had one wicked-looking blunt trauma and skull fracture.
That would explain the scar.
Virgil stated that Moore attacked him in the night with a claw hammer, and that he fought the guy off, but that Moore was alive when he left with Betty Coleman.
They test Virgil?
No, but with an eyewitness and Virgil's record,
they print the hammer?
I sipped my coffee. Missing.
She did it. Finished this Moore guy off after Virgil split and then took the drugs.
Yeah, but she was a petite little blonde, and Virgil was a 7-foot Indian, dishonorably discharged, and a convicted murderer. I set my empty mug back on the counter. 10 to 12. Dorothy sidled over and motioned with the regular coffee. She knew that the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department ran on heavy fuel.
Can I interrupt long enough for a refill?
We both slid our mugs forward, and I smiled up at her. How's the usual coming? She studied me some more and then turned toward the grill. I looked down at the file and once again lowered my voice. The prison psychologist, this Jim McKee at the Nebraska State Pen, got the Native American Defense League to check Virgil's records, and neither of them thought he did it, so they started an investigation. Turned out Peter Moore had a record as long as my arm, and they found that there was a warrant on a homicide that occurred back in East St. Louis 6 weeks before. She leaned in closer, and I could see the faded freckles at the base of her throat.
Don't spoil it for me. Some other ass clown was beat to death with a hammer.
I swallowed, this time without the assistance of coffee. You got it. The NADL fought the good fight, but Betty Coleman stuck to her story, even after being sentenced to 14 months for possession, after which she committed suicide. I flipped the folder shut. Virgil did 10 with good behavior and went to the VA when he got out. I sighed. Where he'd just disappeared. No tax records, DMV, nothing. I asked Quincy, but he says it happens a lot with the Indians. They just disappear into the res, and I never heard from again.
17 and 10. She crossed her arms and turned her stool toward me. You think he's been living under the highway for 9 years?
I don't know. Dorothy turned back and put 2 Denver omelets in front of us. I considered my plate. This the usual?
She wrote up a check for the tourists and walked away without looking at me. Usually.
I am a big man, but with current company I was feeling a little measly. I may be an inch taller than Henry, but the other 2 men standing in my reception area barely missed hitting their heads on the trim above the entryway as they came up the steps. The first giant leaned over to pull me in for a one-arm hug, for which I was grateful, since I'd seen Brandon White Buffalo lift Henry Standing Bear with both arms and hold him off the ground till the bear's face had gone redder. Lawman, how are you?
Still stuck with myself.
The other giant, and Henry's special guest, was maybe in his 40s, and looked strangely familiar. I smiled and extended my hand. Walt Longmire, have we met?
Eli White Buffalo.
He shook my hand and then stepped back. His hands were large and soft, but capable.
No, we haven't.
He was perhaps a shade shorter than Brandon, but not by much, and wore a freshly starched white dress shirt, jeans with a cowboy crease, a hand-tooled belt with a large turquoise belt buckle, and black alligator boots. His glossy black hair was pulled back in a single ponytail that was held with an elaborate silver and turquoise clasp. Artist. Had to be. Eli seemed a little nervous, placed his hands in his back pockets, and then glanced toward Ruby, who sat quietly watching the 2 giants from behind the reception desk. Dog was with her. He stared at us, seemingly noncommittal. Vic studied both men from her perch on Ruby's desk. Brandon placed a hand on my shoulder, covering it.
You think you have some of my family, lawman?
It's possible. He smiled the great smile and inclined his head.
Let's go see.
They were on game 9 for the morning, and from the look on Lucian's face, I assumed he had yet to beat the Colossus. I walked over to the board.
You win one yet?
He muttered and pulled his unlit pipe from his mouth.
No, and I'm about to get my ass kicked again.
He looked at his king on the border, which was completely surrounded by other pieces and a smothered mate. He kept his finger on the black sovereign, finally tipping him over. The old sheriff turned and looked at the collected force, including the gigantic Indians.
Jesus, just what he needs, reinforcements.
I scooped up the board and transferred it to the counter of the kitchenette. I noticed that Eli remained near the doorway and around the corner with Vic. Lucian stood to the side, but his chair remained in front of the cell. Brandon ignored it and stood in front of the bars. He looked down at Virgil, who was still seated on the bunk.
Na hoea oce.
The giant in the cell remained silent, lowering the hand that had held his hair back, the hair once again covering his face, and both enormous hands hanging limp over his knees. Brandon stooped down and looked through the bars. He was speaking Cheyenne.
Netsehesen, netsehe.
Virgil breathed in deeply and let out with a sigh, still saying nothing. Brandon leaned in and placed a hand on the bars, smoothly shifting from Cheyenne to Lakota.
Nituwe huo.
The giant's head rose to look at Brandon, but he still said nothing.
Tokia yaon han huo.
Still nothing.
Taku enisiapi huo.
The voice erupted, hoarse from no practice, and he spoke in a deep bass.
Tatankaska.
Brandon touched his chest and smiled.
Lila Tatankaska.
Virgil's head inclined, and he leaned forward just a little.
Neate kintanya nikaji. Kanhanp hans kaetan maku wopt kela onzoge.
Brandon choked out a laugh, finally turning to look at us.
This is my uncle, who used to call me Begs for Candy in short pants.
His eyes strayed from Henry and me, and he looked toward Eli, motioning him to step forward so that he could introduce him as he stood and spoke to Virgil again, but this time in Crow.
And I did that look about Jack, Eli.
As Eli stepped around the corner, Virgil slowly rose, standing almost a full head above the other two. Eli stepped to the bars and looked up into the face of the giant, and, to our utter amazement, he spit. I've been spit on. It's a part of law enforcement that you never get used to, but it hardly ever comes completely unexpectedly. This did, and it was a mouthful. I stepped forward and put a hand on his shoulder. Hey, there's no need. He shrugged me off and lunged at the bars where he got a hold of Virgil's hair and pulled his face into the metal. Virgil offered no resistance, but Brandon grabbed Eli's other arm and pulled it. As the younger man yanked Virgil's head into the bars again, he screamed at him.
Vasika! Tuk tetarhan! Yauho! Tokel onik lakin kituaho! Tako ekin! Ekel ikanusni!
With Henry and Lucian's help, we got Eli away, but the effort threw all of us off balance and onto the floor in an agitated version of Twister. Eli was the first to stand, and he spit on Virgil again, whose face was bleeding from a busted lip. Eli stopped as we all scrambled to get up and made a dismissive gesture.
Le tua da sunka huo!
He slammed his fists against the bars, then turned and strode out of the room and down the hallway. He pushed Vic back as he went. I was the first of the pile to the door and loped after Vic down the hall after Eli. We found him on the hardwood floor at the bottom of the stairs, in a reverse wrist lock with Tran Van Tuyen's knee lodged at the small of the Indian's back. Dog was barking from behind Ruby's desk, and she stood with her open mouth covered with her hand. I looked at the man in the black leather jacket and black slacks, who looked particularly small in comparison with Eli White Buffalo. He smiled a flat smile up at me.
Is this the man who killed my granddaughter?
I shook my head. No, it isn't. The sickly smile faded, and his eyes turned back to the large man he'd incapacitated.
Then, perhaps, I should let him go?
Tan Son Nhut, Vietnam, 1968. Baranski and Mendoza stood away from the bars and watched me impassively.
Why don't you tell us what you were doing out there near the old fort with a dead girl?
I could feel a cooling in my face and my hands steadied. The security police had put a pretty good set of lumps on my head, and evidently somebody had stood on my hand while they'd cuffed me, because most of the skin on the back of my fingers was gone. There was a metal desk by the doorway leading to the brig where I was being held. Let me out of here. Mendoza sat on the edge of the desk and thumbed the crease in his uniform pants.
Near as we can tell, you left the lounge a little after Mike came, and the APs at Gate 055 said you came by there.
Open this damn door. My eyes stayed on them as they looked at each other.
They said you weren't alone, man.
Now. Mendoza sighed and reached behind him and picked up my sidearm, wrapped in the Sam Brown holster, and handed a large ring of keys to Baranski.
The major's getting your papers together. Looks like you're headed back, pronto.
I didn't say anything but just stood there looking at them with my hands chiseled into fists. Baranski shook his head and stepped forward, unlocking the bars and stepping back and out of the way as I pushed the cell door open. They followed me out, down the hallway, and through the front door of the security headquarters onto the sunny streets of Tan Son Nhut's miniature city. Mendoza hung back but handed my holstered Colt to Baranski, who quickened his pace to pull up beside me.
The CO says they would have shipped your ass out today, but with the heightened security and the holiday, they couldn't make arrangements to transport you back to BHQ.
The CID man reached up and grabbed my shoulder, but I slapped his arm away and pulled up short. I grabbed him by the front of his shirt and leveraged him across the dirt street and into a corrugated sheet metal wall. Mendoza grabbed my arm, but I elbowed him and pushed him out of the way. I turned back to Baranski, and without my even having time to notice, he had pushed the blunt barrel of my sidearm under my chin. He held it there. He smiled, and I heard the unmistakable sound of the .45 being cocked. Neither of us blinked. You better pull that trigger, 'cause that's the only way you're going to stop me. I saw his eyes shift, and we both heard the safeties go off of more than one M16 behind me and to the right. A voice I didn't know spoke in a steady and loud tone.
We got a problem here, Lieutenant.
Baranski's eyes were turned to mine and widened just a little. I slowly released him. I could see four security airmen from the 377th, all of them with their automatic weapons trained on my right eye. Baranski spoke quickly. Look, there's no need. One of the security detachment, a captain, swiveled the barrel of his rifle toward the CID man.
You want to secure that weapon, sir?
Baranski lowered the 45 just a bit, and then carefully used both hands to aim the barrel at the dirt and lowered the hammer, and slowly glided the Colt back into my loose holster, which was wound around his fist. We're clear. The airmen lowered their M16s to their hips, still keeping them generally pointed in our direction. The captain was a goofy-looking guy, with eyebrows and a smile that sloped down at the sides of his face.
Not too smart having a riot just outside of security headquarters, sir.
Mendoza was still sitting on the ground, but Baranski straightened his collar, smoothed the front of his uniform, and tucked my 45 under his arm. No riot, Captain, just a little inter-service miscommunication. The captain continued to study me from under his helmet, and it was like a voice coming from a cave. I got the feeling most of his brains were down in his neck, and he probably had the same thoughts about me.
You're the Marine who broke the nose on one of my men last night?
My breath gummed up my throat, but I still got it out. Coincidentally. I sounded sarcastic, maybe even more than I wanted to. He watched me and then nodded.
Well, why don't we just take this little party back inside?
There's no need for that, Captain. Baranski took a step forward and flipped out his ID. We're with security, too. The captain studied the Central Intelligence Detachment card and badge, looked at Baranski, then at me. He took a step back and fully lowered his weapon. They all did.
All right, sir.
Baranski smiled, showing the gaps in his front teeth, and stuffed his wallet back in his pants. Thanks, Cap. I owe you one. The security detachment backed away from us and continued down the street. Baranski spoke in a soft, friendly voice and continued to smile as the captain glanced back at us one last time. That's right, keep going, you stupid motherfuckers. One final wave, and he turned to look at me. I met his eye and thought about how calm he'd been with my pistol under my chin. I'm not leaving until I find out who killed her. He shook his head and bumped up a smoke from the Camels in his breast pocket. He bit the cigarette and extended the pack to me. I don't smoke. He flipped open his Zippo and lit up with a deep inhale, the streams of smoke continuing into his nostrils as he pulled the cigarette away from his mouth. Maybe you should. It might help calm you down. I was hoping that you could assist me in making the arrangements for my granddaughter's body to be transported once it's released. Tien sat in the chair opposite my desk and held the cup of coffee Ruby had given him. Certainly. Tran Van Tuyen was speaking into the mug and had yet to look up. You may find this strange, but I was actually thinking of a cremation and scattering her ashes near the place she died. I was a little surprised. You don't want to take her back to California? His head shook slightly. I don't think her spirit was ever happy there, and I was thinking that she could perhaps find peace here. I nodded and tipped the rim of my hat, which was resting crown down on my desk. I watched as it turned slightly to the left. Well, with a situation like this, it may be a while before they release Hoti, so you'll have a bit of time to think about that. There was no immediate response, and I hoped that he was coming to terms with the loss. It's a standard procedure with an open homicide investigation. We don't want to miss anything that might lead us to apprehending the individual responsible. Yes, I understand. He didn't say anything else, so I waited. I'd sacrificed lunch with Vic, who had joined Katie and Michael. The Cheyenne Nation and the Crow contingency were having a cooling-off period out on the bench beside the walkway leading to the courthouse. I had told them to wait, that I'd be out as soon as I was through with Tuyen. I'd gotten a washcloth for Virgil, run it under some hot water, and handed it to him. We still had a doctor's examination to contend with, and I wanted to get a closer look at the big man's face. but it was all going to have to wait until I was finished with the dead woman's grandfather. Tuyen had followed me back to my office, and here we sat.
"That was pretty slick out there." His head rose, and he looked at me blankly. "With Eli?"
There was a sudden look of realization, and he sighed a quick laugh. "It is difficult to forget once you have been properly trained."
"Yep."
After a moment he spoke again. "Do you think about the war a great deal, Sheriff?" I touched the brim of my hat with a forefinger in an attempt to straighten it and was relieved that someone else was asking the question.
"A lot more lately, it seems."
"Because of my granddaughter?" I looked up at him.
"Yep, I believe so."
He stood and put the untouched cup of coffee on the corner of my desk, and I thought about offering him tea next time. "Would it be possible for me to see my granddaughter's things?" It was the third time he'd asked, and DCI had returned some of the items, so I nodded and motioned for him to follow me to the basement, to our personal belongings cabinets. Once there, I opened the large drawer and placed the small collection of items on the counter. The purse, the change, the French novel, the scarf, and the keys. The photograph of Mai Kim and me was being held, along with her clothes and herself. "What would you like to do about the car?" He looked at the small group of objects.
"Excuse me?"
"The car she was driving. I was wondering what you'd like to have done with it."
"I may want to look at it."
"I wonder why."
"I can make arrangements for it to be shipped back up here from Cheyenne if you want."
"Yes. Thank you."
I waited as he looked at the items on the counter.
"And the computer?"
"Excuse me?"
He cleared his throat. "Ho Ti had a computer of mine. It was not with her?"
"No."
I studied him as he continued to look at her things. "Is there something wrong?" He took a deep breath.
"It doesn't seem like a great deal. For a lifetime, does it?"
I pushed open the door and walked out to the war council. "How's it going?" Eli sat on the far side of the bench, his elbows on his knees, and looked as though he was memorizing the cracks in the sidewalk. Brandon stood with his thumbs hitched in the back pockets of his jeans, and Henry watched the side of Eli's face. The Cheyenne Nation turned and looked up at me.
"This may take a while."
I beat a slow retreat back to my office. Ruby was holding her phone up to me.
"Sizer Vittoria."
I came inside and sat on her desk, took the receiver and reached down to pet dog.
"What's up, Sancho?"
"Jim Kraft wants to know if you have any idea how many credit cards the Flying J truck stop processes in a 24-hour period."
I ruffled dog's ear and he mouthed my hand with his big teeth.
"Tell him I'll buy him lunch next time I'm through Casper."
I wiped the slobber off on my jeans. "What have you got?"
"The manager says that there was a card left at the counter and that they contacted the company, who in turn contacted Tuyen."
"Well, it was worth a try."
"Boss, there's something else."
His tone froze me.
"What?"
"The manager says that he remembered the incident because he was running an inventory that night and got a glimpse of the car as it pulled away."
"Yep."
"He said the card came back declined and reported stolen. So the woman working the register called it in and they told her to confiscate it. She did, and got the manager as the girl ran out of the store with two bottles of water and a large bag of chips. The manager said he saw the suspect jump in and back into a car.